Welcome everyone to this fourth session of the Soil Depths webinar. It has been an exciting journey, I think. This is an initiative of a group of students and lecturers at the Faculty of Architecture La Cambre Horta of the Free University of Brussels. This initiative has been financially possible thanks to the contribution of the Culture Commission of the same faculty, and especially thanks to her Vice Dean, Marcel Rabinovich. Alice Paris and Alice Mouvet designed and managed the nice webpage that is used as a gateway to this webinar. Benoit Berkel, here next to me, and I, Nadia Casabella, took care of the organization. But it's the generous contribution of all lecturers and moderators that make this webinar possible. We are enormously grateful to all of them. Lola Richel, Germain Modemans, and Serge Kempeners took part in the first session dedicated to what soil. Koen Roijens, Frederica Tati, and Francisco Davila took part in the second session with the name Soil Being Many. Yesterday, we had a session with Claire Pentecost, Seth Dennison, and Bruno Notteboom around the question of soil constituencies. And today, we are going to deal with the brewing soil. Without much ado, I give the word to Benoit. Thank you for being there.
So, good day to everyone. Today we have the pleasure to have with us Ken de Koman, Yannick DeVos and Julia Verga for this fourth session, which we entitled Bearing Soil. Is the soil a resource or an actor to engage in our architectural design? We thank you, the three of them, already for their input and presentation. And I would like to introduce them briefly. Ken de Koman is an architect and a co-founder of BC Architects and Studies and BC Materials. With this company, the work of BC spans from architecture and research, expertise and experiments, but also material production and contracting. I guess Ken will explain us further in his presentation their practice. BC was participating in the Biennale d'Architettura di Venezia, but also the Triennale in Oslo and in the International Architecture Biennale of Rotterdam in 2018, and as a laureate of the B Circular and Vlaanderen Circulaire grant programs. Yannick DeVos is an archaeologist and he's a postdoctoral researcher at the Maritime Culture Research Institute at the VUB. Over the last 20 years, his research focused on urban geoarchaeology. Other research themes he worked on include the Holocene evolution of the Seine Valley in Brussels, and he is currently coordinating the paleo and archaeo-environmental studies in the Brussels region. He's also responsible for the geoarchaeological studies in the region, including field study sampling and micromorphology. Today, the session will be moderated by Julia Verga, who studied architecture and urbanism in different cities in Europe. She's interested in spaces understood as the physical supports of complex interaction. She has arrived in Brussels 10 years ago almost, first working with the collective Rotor, and afterwards collaborating with Carbon Architects, also in Brussels. Since 2017, she's teaching at the VUB, at the Urban and Architectural Design Studio of the Brew Phase at VUB and ULB. And she has started a PhD research on the spatial implication of current regional ambition to foster circular economy in Brussels. Thank you very much to you three. I leave the words to Julia.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much. I'm also very pleased to moderate this session. What is particular, I think, of today is that we're actually hosting two Brussels research practices and actually architecture and urban practice. So this is quite exciting. And I'm really looking forward to the presentation and especially to debate very urgent questions in the session, in the debate afterwards. And now I invite Yannick to share his presentation.
Thank you. Let's see, it's working. Just activate it. Can you see the screen? Okay. So good afternoon. Well, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to talk about my favorite topic, which is the memory of urban soils. Now, before I start, it's maybe useful that I explain what I'm doing. Well, actually, I'm a geoarchaeologist, and that means that I apply methods and principles from earth science and archaeology. And this in order to study past interactions of humans and their environment. Now, the idea of the talk of today is basically to show the potential of urban soils to understand past urban development and also how we can come to a better understanding of how people were actually interacting with the environments in urban areas in the past. Now, we've heard this already before, but soils and sediments are an essential part of towns. And as they remain typically hidden from view and basically only surface during road construction, demolition, or construction works, they do not get the attention they deserve. And well, it's already shown over during this week, so I will not repeat it, but the urban soil has multiple functions. And one of the functions is that it also has a memory. So urban soils have a memory. And for me, as a geoarchaeologist, the soils and sediments themselves are my study object. Now, why are urban soils so important for archaeologists? Well, first of all, because all the archaeological objects that we find during an excavation are surrounded and protected by the soil. And I just show you here some examples. Here we have some posts which are nicely preserved within the soil. Here we have some hundreds of jaws of animals that are also nicely preserved within the soil. And here you see a nice soil profile showing us all different materials that have been preserved. So we're talking about brick fragments. We also have pieces of ceramics and so on and so further. But it's very important for us as archaeologists to know that the soil basically serves as a kind of container, keeping all the artifacts in a good status. But it's not always the case. In some cases, the soil can also make things disappear. Think about bones, for instance. If you have very acid soils, they will decompose very quickly. So that's for us as archaeologists very important to know. Also, if a soil is quite dry, the organic materials will decompose also quite quickly. So these are all things that we have to take into account. But for us, basically, the soil is a matrix where we find all the artifacts. Now, the soil itself can also be a direct witness of ancient activities. And I will just show you this one example. What we have on this picture here are all these gray lines, which are basically implement marks. These are marks that have been made by people when they were digging in the soil. So these are all spade marks, and they give us direct information about ancient agricultural practices. So, for instance, this layer is dating from the 13th century, so we know that at that particular place, people were doing agriculture in the 13th century. Now, a third function is that the soil is also a witness of landscape evolution. I just drew here three pictures. The first one showing how the soil witnessed basically that during Holocene times, big parts of Brussels were still under forest. So we have these forest soils. Later on, we see in other locations that we also have, especially in medieval times, quite a lot of agricultural soils. And a third example is a more recent urban soil where we see a lot of concrete present. Another function, and we've heard it already in the previous talk, soil can also be a resource, quite an important resource. And this was also the case in the past. And I just show you here an example of a building which was made with wattle and daub, but it also was used for making bricks and ceramics and so on and so forth. So it's also a very important resource. And well, I would like to use the words of my mentor, Roger Langer, who always told me that the soil is a book. And the idea of today is a bit to invite you to read together with me a few pages of this interesting book of soils. And well, the first step that we have to do is, of course, open the book. And how do we open the book of soils? Well, it's basically by excavating. We need soil trenches that we can observe the soil. And well, over the last 20 years, we have had the opportunity to study quite a lot of these trenches in the historical center of Brussels. Basically, all the dots that you can see here are interventions that have taken place over the last 20 years. The ones in yellow have been studied in detail. The ones in blue are very much ongoing work. So you can basically see that we have quite a dense grid. And now I will focus during this talk mostly on Brussels. And well, to give you an idea of how these trenches look like, they can be quite spectacular. Some of you may still recall the excavation that have been taking place at Tour et Taxi a few years ago, where we found an ancient branch of the Seine River. And what we see, basically, these are very big trenches. It has also been part of an exposition a few years ago. And if you want, you can still visit part of it when you enter the building of the Flemish community, which is built on top of the excavation. A more recent excavation, which was also quite spectacular, was Parking 58, of which there is an exposition currently going on in Halle Saint-Géry. So you can go and have a visit. It's an exhibition with a free entrance. Well, we will show you a bit what we have been finding on this site, which was quite interesting because there we had the remains of the ancient medieval harbour of Brussels. But not all the trenches that we have been excavating were that spectacular. In many cases, they are very small, sometimes very deep, but mostly very small. But still, all these small windows together give us quite a good idea on what happened with the urban soil in the past. So I was saying that I will focus on Brussels here, but we also did quite a lot of interventions in Flanders, but never on such an extensive scale. So it's mostly one or two excavations where we intervened, but never on a very systematic scale, as was the case for Brussels. Now, when we are talking about urban archaeology and urban stratigraphy, so the following up of the different layers, it's mostly a story of complexity. We have to face very complex situations. And well, a Danish colleague of mine liked this very much, this cartoon in which he shows different types of headaches. And you can see that the worst case is basically urban stratigraphy because of its tremendous complexity. And what makes it so complex is because we have multiple generations of occupation on these sites, which means that we have many different layers that are cutting and recutting each other, so which makes it quite a complex story. And on top of that, we also have two particular types of layers which are very difficult for us as archaeologists to understand. On the one hand, it's what we call the famous dark earth, and on the other hand, microstratified layers. Now, as for what concerns the urban dark earth, it is basically a very thick deposit in which we do not see much stratigraphy. So it means that it's very difficult to understand what its significance is. And on the other hand, we have these very tiny layers of a few millimeters thick, which you can barely see. And of course, also these ones are very difficult to interpret based on field data alone. Now, coming back to these dark Earths, it's not just in Brussels nor just in Flanders that we find them. We do find them all over Europe, basically. It's a very, very widespread phenomenon. All the countries which are indicated in blue are basically the countries where they have been studied on a quite extensive scale. So you have, for instance, dark Earth from London, Italy, France, and so on and so further. Now, the big question with these dark Earths is, of course, how can we study them? Huh? How can we understand what their significance is? Now, in a first step, the archaeologists took quite some drastic measures, and they just removed it as quickly as possible. But then they realized, of course, that they were also removing part of the urban history, which makes it, of course, very difficult to understand the urban development. So in the next step, the idea was, well, we will sieve all these deposits. Huh? We will sieve all the dark earth and see what is inside. And it's very interesting because we get a very detailed idea about the content of these dark earths. But still, we cannot understand how these dark earths formed, nor what their archaeological interest may be. If we want to understand that, we have to apply geoarchaeology. So what do we do as geoarchaeologists? Well, we do take specific samples, we perform quite a lot of chemical analysis, and the most important thing is we do a micromorphological study. Now, what is this micromorphological study? Well, it basically starts in the field where we take block samples. So we do take blocks of soil, and well, such a block of soil you can hardly put under a microscope like that. It's quite friable, it's too thick, so you can't see a thing. So what we do is we impregnate these blocks with resin. And once they have become hard as rock, we can cut off a very thin slice. And with a very thin slice, I mean something about 0.02 millimeter thick. So about 20 micron thick, so very thin, so that it becomes translucent. Huh? And that's something that we can study under the microscope. Why is it so interesting for us to study these blocks under the microscope? Well, I'll just show you this example here where you see such a thin section. And if you have a look at it, you can immediately see that we have different layers. Although when we look at the field profile, it seems to be just one single layer. So just by looking at this thin section, we can start to distinguish the different layers. And what's also important, all the components are kept in their original position because we just impregnated the blocks and nothing did move. So that makes it very interesting because from that moment on, we can understand relations between the different elements and we can understand how these soils formed. And, well, this picture may seem a bit complicated, but stay with me, I'll explain briefly. So how did the dark earth in Brussels form? Well, it all starts with the plant material, so natural soil. And then we have different factors that are influencing this. And we're talking about climate, about topography, we're talking about time, we have continuity versus hiatus, and very important, we have a whole series of non-cultural processes. Now, what are these non-cultural processes that we're talking about? Bioturbation, that means earthworms which are digging moles that are making their galleries, thinking about roots. And we also can have erosion, sedimentation, different processes of soil formation that can also happen, such as humification, mineralization. We can have clay translocation, we can have when the soil becomes more wet or less wet, oxidative reduction, we can have traces of acidification or just the opposite, alkalinization. So these are all processes that we can identify. And what's also important is that we can also identify human alterations and modifications. So then we are thinking about the accumulation of different types of material, domestic waste, manure, cess, construction debris, industrial and artisanal waste. We can also observe the mixing of materials, truncation, removal of materials, and sometimes also compaction. And what for us as archaeologists is the most important part is this part here in the center. We can identify activities that have led to the formation of this dark earth. And well, I just put here some pictures just showing the diversity of activities that can be at the origin of formation of a dark earth. Now, such an urban dark earth is quite often a long term process. It's something that forms sometimes over several centuries, and that implies that it's mostly not related to just one single activity. So quite often we are facing different types of activities, different types of non-cultural processes, changing environmental factors, and so on and so further. So that's why we have this arrow, which goes the whole way back, showing that we can have a repetition or an alternation of different types of activities and processes going on. And just to show you one practical example, I will show you this site, which is called the Court of Hoogstraten. It's situated in the center of Brussels, next to the Royal Palace, and also next to the ancient palace of the Dukes. So, and it's this arrow here in red, which is indicating the location, exact location of the site. And it's quite interesting because we were able, just by studying the urban soil, to reconstruct the whole biography of the site. And this biography starts somewhere in the 9th, 10th century. And what we did identify at that moment is a kind of grassland soil. So it was grassland, which was probably under pasture. In the next phase, or in the 10th, 13th century, we see that everything got transformed into crop fields. On top of part of these crop fields, there was the installation of a stable in the middle of the 13th century. The stable got destroyed. And what happens next? Then we see the deposition of more than 1 meter of rubble and building debris. And what's interesting is that we see that in the 15th, 16th century, this building debris is becoming basically the foundation for the creation of the garden of this Court of Hoogstraten. And today, well, everything is being incorporated within the museum on the Kardenberg that you can still visit today. So that just to show you one outcome of the study of such a single site. And why is it so important that we can do this kind of stuff as archaeologists? Well, if we're talking about recent urban developments, we have quite a lot of documentation at our service. And it's basically already in the case from Renaissance times on, because we do have all these detailed maps, like for instance, the map of Deventer, which is in the background, and other maps where you can really see where was the river exactly passing through town, where were all the houses situated, where are the open squares. So we get quite a detailed information on how the space was organized. But if we are talking about more early periods, then we do not have all this information. And well, it has led to quite some heated debates among historians and archaeologists because of this lack of documentation. And it's not just a lack of historical sources. Also, if we have a look at the archaeological features, they become very scarce for these periods of early urban development. And so the idea was, if we would have a look at the urban soil itself and let the soil itself tell his story, maybe we can add some new information. And so that's basically what we were able to do over the last 20 years. We had so many interventions in the center of town that we could make this kind of activity maps. So we can show where were actually the different activities located in different periods. And the first map that we were able to make is one from the 10th, 12th century AD. And it's showing us basically quite a lot of crop fields and pasture land. So basically, for this 10th, 12th century, Brussels still seems to be a very rural area. And of course, we have to make abstraction of the first and the second city wall because they were not built yet, but it's just a bit to orient ourselves. Now, if you have a look at the next arc, showing us the situation in the 13th and the beginning of the 14th century, then we see already things are changing. We see more evidence for settlements. We see the appearance of some gardens, we see the appearance of market activities, but there are still quite a lot of crop fields present. Now, if you look at the map for the 14th, 16th century, then we see a real seizure. Now, we do not have any traces for crop fields in the historical center anymore, especially not within this area, which is surrounded by the first city wall. What do we have instead is quite a lot of gardens. So we have evidence for a lot of gardens. We have evidence for lots of construction works going on, so destruction, construction. It seems to be an endless circle of activities that's going on. So lots of building activities. We see also the appearance of artisanal activities, which become also quite intense. And we have something peculiar, which is what we call a dung alley. So it's kind of back alley where people were accumulating all kinds of excremental waste. But I will come back to that later on. Now, it's interesting to have an idea on how space was organized in different periods, but there's also another topic that we can study just by studying the urban soil itself. Because in historical sources, we see that there are quite some complaints about pollution in the past, about people that were throwing all the waste out of the windows, animals which are wandering freely through the streets. So is there a way that we can measure this kind of pollution in a quantifiable way? And there again, the study of ancient soil pollution can help us. But we have to be careful because there are quite a lot of pitfalls, and the two main pitfalls are basically that we have to take into account background noise. And background noise, that means that some chemical elements are already present naturally. And so they're not related to any human pollution. And we also need to perform what we call a taphonomical history study. A taphonomical study, that means that we need to study the processes that happened after the site was abandoned or got out of use or whatever. And it's very important that we do that, because if you are performing a chemical analysis, you're basically measuring the actual status of the soil. So we have to make sure that the actual status is also corresponding to the ancient pollution status. So once we've performed all these studies, we are also able to draw again some maps now on heavy metal pollution. And we did this also for the 10th, 13th century. And what becomes immediately clear is that there is almost no elevated elements that are present. So there's no real pollution. And the slightly elevated concentrations that we do observe seem all to be related to the manuring of the soil. Now, if we have a look at the situation in the 14th, 16th century, then we see a much more diverse picture. And we see indeed that in some locations we do have quite some elevated concentrations. And what's interesting is that we combined all these chemical analyses again with this micromorphological study, allowing us to relate the pollution back to the activities that have been taking place. And so what are the activities that were responsible for this pollution in the 14th, 16th century? And it's mainly, well, no big surprise there, metallurgical activities, also gardening contributes to the concentration of heavy metals. We also see that that building activities can also contribute to higher heavy metal concentration, because many of the building materials do contain quite some concentration of heavy metals, and also burials seems to be places where heavy metals are concentrating. Now, if we have a look at the potential harm of this pollution for the population, then we see that the threshold value is only exceeded in one single case, and it's only slightly exceeded. So that means that basically for pre-industrial periods, heavy metal pollution in Brussels was not harmful for the population at all. So that's also quite interesting to know. Now, we also looked at another element, which was also quite interesting for us, and that's phosphorus. Because people were mainly complaining about organic pollution, because the other one is they could not smell it, they could not feel it. It may have been there, but they were not always aware of its existence. That's quite different for organic pollution. And so why phosphorus? Because human activities such as manuring, food storage, preparation and consumption, burials, keeping of animals, they all result in more elevated concentration of this element within the soil. So that's why it's quite interesting for us. And so again, a map showing concentration for the 10th, 13th century. Obviously, the elevated concentration seems again to be related to the manuring of the soil. No big surprises here. And for the 14th, 16th century, we have again a much more diverse picture. And many of the pollution seems, or a concentration of phosphorus seems to be related to typical activities, going again to the accumulation of all kinds of excrements in latrines, cesspits, but also in these kind of back alleys, and also quite a lot with gardening activities that were going on. Now, when we are talking about pollution, we can also talk about something else, and that's how were people in the past dealing with their waste? How did they manage their waste? And what's quite interesting is that we see that for the 10th, 13th century, most of the waste ended up within the stable or on the manor heap, where it served as a kind of manure, basically, manure and fertilizer that was thrown onto the fields. And this was quite necessary, because the soils that were cultivated in this 10th, 13th century in the center of Brussels, they were poor, sandy soils, so they needed a lot of this manure. So we have more or less a kind of circular economy at that moment. Now we see that things are changing. In the 14th, 16th century, we have a completely different picture, but quite interesting. And a site which is quite interesting for this topic is the site of Rue d'une Personne in Manstraat, situated next to the Grand Place. And why is it so interesting? Because it shows us how people dealt with waste in this period. And we see that they did some kind of sorting of the waste. We have here nice pits, which is filled with hundreds and even if not thousands of fragments of jaws of animals. And well, it was basically all these jaws that were broken to extract the oil. And what we see is that they were selected then and thrown all in the same pit. We also have another pit, which is containing also only one single type of waste. And in this case, it's hundreds, if not thousands, of fragments of leather, leather shoes that have got out of use. Now, again, much more traces of this selection of waste. We also found for this period quite some latrines, when the cess was accumulating. And we also have what I come back to this now, this kind of dung alley. I also found a picture from the Renaissance where that's a bit showing how such a back alley may have looked like in the past. And what's interesting here is that we see that although excremental waste was accumulating within this back alley, which must have been quite a dirty environment, we also see that people tried to remediate on it. So they put quite some straw on top of it to limit the bad odors, and they also added some ashes again against the bad odors. And what's also interesting is that we see quite a lot of traces that people have been regularly digging away all these excrements, and what's probably they served later on as a fertilizer onto the many gardens that we have been identifying in Brussels. And what's interesting, we just performed a study of such a 16th century garden, and we see that we have quite a lot of human parasites in them. So giving indeed the impression that the human excrements were indeed used as fertilizer for these gardens. Now, to talk further about these gardens, this is the garden from the Court of Hoogstraten that I showed you previously. And what we see here is that this garden is constructed on top of waste. So here we see that all this rubble and construction debris serve basically as a foundation. So again, we see a nice selection of the waste. Now, according to what I have been telling now, it seems that everything was very well organized. But then we excavated Parking 58 and we discovered something else. We discovered several of these horses which were present, complete. We have complete carcasses, so indicating that the whole animal has been thrown into the river and must have been floating along in the river. So that means that people have been dumping all kinds of waste in these rivers. And that's indeed also what some historical sources are telling us. Huh? They are complaining about all these dead animals which are floating in the river. And that seems also to be a reality. So not everything was always that well organized. Now, I would also very briefly like to talk a bit about the Seine River itself, because we can get quite a lot of information about how it evolved over time. By looking at the urban soil again, and it's especially interesting because the river itself has completely disappeared from the historical center of Brussels today. So I will very briefly talk about Tour et Taxi, Rue d'Arschot and Rue de Quatre. Now, for the site of Rue d'Arschot, it's quite interesting. So during construction works in a parking lot, we discovered an ancient branch of the Seine River. You can see here quite an old one, which because it's more than 10,000 years old, and it gives us an idea on how the river looked like at that period. So we do not have one single big channel. It's really a braided river with all small channels, no permanent channels. And just to show you, we've also found the bone of a mammoth in it. So that's for glacial times. And then we go to the site of Tour et Taxi, where we have remains of an ancient branch of the Seine River dating from Roman periods. And what we see now is that we are facing a meandering river. And we also see the efforts that people were doing to try to push this river in a fixed bedding. So we have quite a lot of construction works going on there. So we go from this braided river system to meandering river system. And what's interesting, from the 4th century on, we see that this branch got cut off. So it was no more part of the main river, the Seine River. And that means also that there was no flowing water anymore. So we got standing water. We got a kind of pond that was created until it got completely filled up and disappeared out of the landscape somewhere in the 6th, 7th century AD. That was also quite interesting to observe. And then the last site I very quickly want to talk about is site of Rue de Quatre, Rue d'Argent, which was basically a kind of jackpot for us as archaeologists, because we discovered quite a thick peat deposit of more than 1 meter thick. And why is it so interesting? Because we can find quite a lot of microfossils in them. We're talking about pollen, seeds, sponge spicules, so the little skeletons of sponges, diatoms, and phytoliths, which are silified plant remains. So that's all very interesting to be able to observe that, because it allows us basically to understand how the landscape evolved over time. And it was really a very interesting sequence, which starts some 11,000 years ago and which goes until 1,000 years ago. So that's really a very nice sequence that we could observe there. So on a very local scale, we see that we start with a very open, wet landscape until we get this very densely forested area, until it opens again, this time probably due to human activities. And on a much more regional scale, it can also inform us about how the landscape evolves from a very open boreal forests until we get this dense forest that we still know of today, and then again the opening of the landscape due to all the agricultural activities. And then, of course, the last image of the Seine River is a very recent excavation of Parking 58, where we see basically how the river got completely anthropized. So human activity really fixed the bedding, so we have the construction of real wall hampering the river to follow its previous course. So in conclusion, what can we say about urban soils? I think that I've been able to show you that urban soils do have a memory, and they allow us to detect spatial organization patterns and also how they evolve over time. They also allow us to understand the interaction between nature and urban population. They help us to obtain objective data on the evolution of pollution in towns. They also help us to identify patterns of waste management and also how these evolve over time. And finally, they can also contribute to the understanding of changes in the physical landscape. So we're talking about relief, riverbeds, I've shown you some examples, and also about vegetation. So I think that we can say that urban soils can really contribute to our understanding of urban development. And of course, this work that has been done very much in collaboration with many colleagues that I really want to thank here. And I would like to thank you for your attention.